crude at best, often ineffective, and even an obstructive tool for achieving urban design and architectural design excellence. So the premise of this, I think this whole meeting today, but certainly my premise is that zoning is very problematic, and in fact, the very word, and I think vocabulary matters, the very word zoning, if you think about what it means, is problematic. We probably need a different word. And as my colleagues have already said, despite good intentions, zoning basically doesn't design anything. It doesn't, or it de facto results in design that you may or may not want or care about. And look at the second bullet. Setting limits concerning uses, densities, building size, and site occupancy says nothing about aspirations for the architecture itself. Now, I'm going to diverge a little bit from my colleagues in that I'm here to talk about urban design and architecture needing to be addressed, not just urban form. Look at the bottom bullet. The premise of conventional zoning is that achieving design excellence depends entirely on the talent of architects, or lack of talent, hired by developers and property owners whose interests understandably focus on design and development of their own property. This is just a reiteration of what Lee talked about earlier, that you have, in the United States in particular, invariably conflict between the public interest and the private interest. Now, here's perhaps a way of thinking about how we operate, how we've been operating historically. You see in the upper left, this is a six-panel slide. I hope all of you can see it. You may not be able to read the text. What the site offers, I mean, that's the given condition. This could be in the Woodmont Triangle, for example. It could be anywhere. A site, you've got neighbors, you have an alley, you have a street, you know, all the kinds of things that we would document in doing our initial analysis before we even put pencil to paper. What zoning allows, there's the zoning envelope. What some neighbors want, that's the recently demolished Sears house from Palisades area where I live. What the developer requires, take note that what the developer requires looks a lot like the zoning envelope. Why is that? Something that has been touched on by my colleagues, which is that the value, the economic value of land is very much a function of highest and best use on that property. So zoning, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that zoning historically has been a way of entitling, or I shouldn't say entitling, I should say conveying to property owners, basically for their doing nothing, intrinsic economic value. So when comes along and buys that property, you see in the upper left slide, the zoning says you can build this kind of a building. Very probably, the price of that land is going to be based on building that complete volume, that envelope. What the architect dreams, I mean, let's be honest, those of us who are architects, you know, we tend to be somewhat ego-driven. The architect dreams about stuff like this all the time. What was finally done, you can see on the lower right, the artful compromise. I'm not suggesting that the final solution isn't a reasonable design, but you can see that there's nothing in the preceding five panels that suggests that what's in the sixth panel is what should be the outcome. And form-based zoning, one of its intentions, I think, is to get a little more prescriptive about what might be done with a property like you see in the upper left. And I think we all are here today because we agree with what you see implied in this image, which is a guy standing over a trash can holding a series of volumes, traffic engineering, the ultimate planning, how to sell mediocrity, learning to live with suburbia, 100 ways to pave new roads, zoning the old-fashioned way, subdivide and conquer, etc. If you're really serious about changing the way we're doing business in Montgomery County when it comes to design and development, a lot of this stuff is going to have to be trashed. Now, I'm suggesting the following, that to achieve design excellence in this county, first you have to establish specific design aspirations. And those concern a lot of things, but I mention a few here. Street patterns, streetscape design, civic spaces, and the architecture that frames and gives form to the public realm. That means considering full range of design alternatives, making choices, because there's more than one way to do things. Establishing fine grain, this is a really important point that my colleagues have made. I've been arguing this for, this gets back to the magic marker approach to planning. We have to give up that method of planning. We have to get a much sharper pencil out. Establish fine-grained three-dimensional design criteria and guidelines governing development and redevelopment. I want to call your attention to the word redevelopment, because a lot of what's going to happen in this century, in my opinion, is going to be redevelopment. It's not going to be taking green fields or brown fields or gray fields and coming up with totally new projects. An awful lot of stuff is going to be recycled, modified, added to, and that poses a problem, a challenge, I should say, for coding. Use form-based codes, not conventional zoning, to realize these aspirations, proactively addressing urban and architectural design. And this cartoon, I think, illustrates the point I just made. On the left is Anywhere USA. This could be someplace near Tyson's Corner. This could be someplace in, it couldn't be Houston, because in Houston they basically used a grid to lay out the macro street network. But it could be anywhere. And as the slide on the right shows, starting with that existing condition on the left, there is something's happened over time to make what I would call a more rational use of land than you see on the left. Choices. We have to make choices. I mean, what kind of pattern do you want to impose on the landscape when you develop? Whether it's, this would suggest you're doing something out in a green field, but it's an issue that comes up time and again, especially in jurisdictions where the county or city plans only identify major arterial roads, and everything inside the enclave, quote unquote, is left up to the developer, which I think is a fundamentally fallacious way to do planning. You see on the left what I think is typical in much of Montgomery County and many other places in the United States, what I call varicose vein planning. And as opposed to what you see on the right, which is a rational grid that I'm more than convinced, whether it's rectilinear or curvilinear, is the only way to do city planning. Notice, I want to point this out to everybody. The dilemma with this is, if you get any problem arising in this network, the whole thing becomes sclerotic. It gets blocked. You can't move. The advantage of any kind of lattice system is that I can, from any one point, I have multiple paths I can travel to get from point A to point B. That's not a trivial point. Excuse me? Yes. Certainly does. Again, to illustrate the point about redevelopment, I think a lot of what we're going to see is places like this getting retrofitted. We're again looking at the possibility of doing this at Tyson's Corner. And finally, reaching the kinds of environments, achieving the kinds of environments that I think my colleagues explained very well earlier. Of course, the woman on the right is expressing a little bit of skepticism, which may or may not be justifiable. This slide is to make a point about it's not just about the traditional new town. It's about any neighborhood or community. It's an attempt to show, as again my colleagues have pointed out, that site specificity is critical. that you have to go look. You have to have a fine-grained approach to planning and to coding, that the way we develop and build out communities is not all at one time. It's in increments. Sometimes it's very small infill things. Sometimes it's whole sections. And the thing that makes it work, the thing that is the key to success, is having what we often in planning call the framework plan. Having a framework plan that's sufficiently specific in terms of land use patterns and networks of travel that will sustain itself, that doesn't need to be revised over time. I always told my students to just go look at L'Enfant's plan of Washington, D.C. If you know, here's a plan. It's a pattern plan. It's not a code-based plan, but what it does do is it provides a framework on the land that's been pretty viable, has held up, is still perceivable for more than 200 years, and that is one of the things that has been missing in many, many places in the United States, that kind of planning. Rob Creer did some studies some years ago showing ways to think about urban form. This is another part of what code-based planning and implementation looks at. You're probably wondering, what the heck is Roger showing here? These are streets. These are just different or alternatives. And these are open spaces, public spaces. And the point, Creer's point in making these drawings was that instead of thinking always about the block and buildings on a block or along a street, what you really have to think about is the nature of the streetscape itself, the public realm, and make choices about what that should be. His catalog of spaces went on to include all kinds of kind of a taxonomy of public open space and how to shape it. These things are not intended to be solutions. They're options. They're ways of thinking about making the public realm. Remember, I had a previous image that said the county needs to make choices, and one of the things it has to make choices about is where should such spaces be, and what should their size be, and how big, and what uses. This is just the three-dimensional version of this. This is to make the point that I think Lee and Jeffrey made earlier, that drawings like this, we academics and practitioners sort of know what that means, but until you sort of see in three dimensions what the implications of that those diagrams are, they're a little abstract. This becomes less abstract. And I would dare say I can't think of a zoning code I know of that has images in it like this that says, at this particular intersection or at this particular place in the fabric, we would like a space of this quality or of this set of proportions. So what we're going to do, we need to get rid of these old rules. You can see the old rules here. Typical zoning. There's a light industrial zone, the twilight zone, the battle zone. The old rules, the new rules, what are we looking at? First of all, we're not even looking at a plan. We're looking at a section. Remember the diagram showing the streets in plan? We need to make choices about the kinds of streets and public realm that we want. Where do we want landmark vertical elements? Where do we want setbacks? Do we want arcades? I mean, this is just one option out of thousands. But you've got to get fine grain. Look at the difference. I mean, here's a good example. I drew an example of two different arcades. And unfortunately, it's not as clear as it could be. Here's an arcade. This is typical of Washington, D.C., where the arcade starts doesn't cover the sidewalk. It starts in back of the sidewalk, and you get another space between the storefronts and the colonnade. This has proved to be undesirable. Ask any merchant. This is, if you're going to build an arcade, is a an arcade that actually covers the sidewalk. A big challenge, achieving architectural excellence. Award-winning architecture is the product of a committed and visionary client, a talented architect, constructive regulatory policies, and a transparent, thorough, but efficient development process. I will tell you right now that if you don't have these ingredients, getting good architecture is very difficult. And the county can't control all of this, but it can deal with regulatory policy and the process. And if the policy and the process are right, then I maintain that the design and development aspirations of the private sector will rise. So let's talk about what we're up against with architectural design, the excellence and the challenge to achieve it. Let me throw out a couple of other premises. Architects are people who are always interested in innovation, but also many of them are committed to tradition. And if you put three architects in a room, you'll get five opinions about almost anything. As this slide shows, over time, in addition to the natural tendency of designers to not agree on everything, there is a tendency to change your mind. So how do you deal with this? How in coding can you deal with with situations like this where you can imagine that there's a framework behind this changing facades that doesn't change over time and that represents what the zoning envelope allowed, but look at the difference in the character of this. I would underscore to you that this is not just cosmetics. This is not just superficial. That the quality of the built environment, the quality of the architecture that frames and define space, public realm, matters. And there are you'll see in a minute, there are many issues that arise other than just, none of which are matters of style. So you've got to, first of all, you've got to deal with the fact that the I'm sorry you're missing the top of this. The guy is saying, tell me, do you do traditional or temporary? And he's saying, I can go either way, man. But it seems to me that we don't have to look very far. We can go to downtown Silver Spring or downtown Bethesda or Washington or Houston and find a lot of buildings that are somehow very unsatisfying. This is not in any particular place, but I'm making the point here that there are a lot of ways to make a building to sculpt its geometry, to select materials, to put together fenestration patterns, and the question is how do you code that? What position do you take in the code, I should say, to get the kinds of results that you would like to have? Here again is another illustration of what I'm talking about. You start with this, which is the box. If you remember the earlier cartoon, the thing that is zoning and ordinance or even a design code might stipulate, but you start embellishing it. This was a cartoon I did in the 80s when Washington was running rampant with postmodernist buildings, almost all of which were deemed pretty pathetic. But this is what you can get, and you may not want this. Perhaps one example of what can happen happen in the 80s. Which is this is Georgetown. This is a cartoon. I wrote two articles about Arthur Cotton Moore's Washington Harbor. Some of you may have been there. In which here was a perfectly good urban design. continue the streets, the street network down to the river. It looked perfectly reasonable in all respects urbanistically. But when you look at the building in its third dimension, when you look at it as finished, Peter Blake, by the way, called the building the Martian Embassy. But it looks like Arthur and his team played the game of festoon. And you can see all these little components over here and spun this thing and made selections. When I wrote this article, I will tell you, Arthur called me up and wanted to have lunch with me and had me tell him what I thought was wrong. So I agreed. He's a very nice guy. I went and had lunch with him, and I turned over the doily on the table in the restaurant, and I said, here's what I think might have been a better way to approach the architectural language of the building. And he actually sort of agreed. Another case in point as to why you may want to be more serious about dealing with architectural expression and language and how it relates to the city. When the Willard expanded, the Willard Hotel downtown Washington expanded, there was a lot, everybody agreed that this was probably that this was probably a reasonable massing strategy. But looking at that slide, I think you can realize that there's 1,000 ways to clad the building. The language, the architectural language in which that building could be composed could be anything. What they chose to do, as you all know, is they took the language of this, abstracted it, reduced it, and carried it over here, which is perhaps the acceptable. It seemed to me and a lot of other architects that they sort of missed an opportunity to do what, in fact, the historic preservation guidelines in the Department of Interior's regulation says, which is that the new stuff should not mimic or ape the old stuff. Issue of scale. I mean, one of the things that is so important, again, you can get all the urban design moves made correctly, but you can have a complete transformation, a negative transformation of perceptions of a space just because someone gets the scale wrong. And here I've taken, to illustrate the point, I've taken a cube. The cube is the same size in every drawing. And just by changing the language and the scale of things, you give completely different readings to that cube. From the monumental to the domestic to the bureaucratic, the multiple readings, enigmatic. We see a lot of that, right, where you really don't know how big or small things are. And then finally, the camouflaged. I'm sorry, the slide. Architects, they're the reason for coding. Going some distance toward coding for architecture is to get the architects to behave themselves. You see here, the guy says, thanks very much. This is presumably a community meeting. Thanks very much for your questions, comments, criticisms, and suggestions for design changes. And the architect is standing over there saying, few of which will ever see the light of day. We fall in love, we architects fall in love with things we design, even if they're bad ideas. Then there's the whole issue of cutting-edge architecture. When do you advocate it or encourage it? And I'm serious here, that there are times when it's appropriate for there to be a kind of hood ornament applied to the fabric of the city. I was just in Bilbao, Spain last month, visiting the Guggenheim Museum that Gary did, and given that context, that site, the conditions were such that the Gary strategy there made complete sense. It's a fabulous building. It was not the place to do a cubic form or something that was in the way of a background building. It's more than a foreground building. It's sort of a centerpiece. Think of it. I think of the Barrow Guggenheim Museum as the kind of centerpiece you put on your dining room table. Which table might be a rectangle or a circle, but the centerpiece wants to have some exuberance. That isn't always appropriate. That's not always appropriate. Maybe it was not appropriate for Gary to do that at the Corcoran Gallery in downtown Washington. So that's another example of the kinds of choices you have to make. There may be places where you should have civic buildings or landmark buildings that should be not treated as simply background buildings, although background buildings can be good architecture. Now, I'm going to run you through an example of, let's call it a case study, of a project I'm very familiar with. Carlisle is in Alexandria, Virginia. This is maybe one of the most farthest along that I know of example of development in which the guide for development, rules for the development amounted to a kind of form-based code. They didn't use that term then. Let me just tell you a little bit about it. Carlisle was a brownfield, the railroad yard west of Old Town between Duke Street and Eisenhower Avenue. Maybe some of you know it. It's near the King Street Metro Station, owned by Norfolk Southern Railroad. Oliver Carr Company was selected as the master developer. This is in the late 80s. In 1990, Cooper Robertson prepared Cooper Robertson is a planning and architecture firm in New York City, prepared a very, very elaborate master development plan for Carlisle with detailed design guidelines for each block. City adopted the master plan. This gets back to implementation, so Lee might be interested in this. They decided to adopt the master plan as an overlay, what they call an SUP, special use permit, that superseded the zoning. In 1994, a landscape architecture firm, prepared streetscape design guidelines, which goes along with the plan. In effect, as I've said, the SUP was an early version of a form-based design code. The city also enacted legislation creating a design review board for Carlisle. Now, I should disclose, I've been a member of that board for about 15 years. I'm the outside non-stakeholder. One of the two architects on the board, so I get to go to the meetings and say almost anything I want to say because I don't live there. The DRB was authorized to review all Carlisle projects, not only to ensure compliance with SUP and streetscape design guidelines, but also to evaluate, make judgments, and offer suggestions about all aspects of project architecture visible to the public. So we couldn't have cared less about the elevator core. We didn't look at the fire stairs, but everything else that was visible to the public, including from the roof of adjacent buildings, was of concern. So to give you a little bit of context, this is the Capitol Beltway. This is Duke Street, Eisenhower Avenue. This is Carlisle, and I forget how many acres it is, but it's about 40 or 50 acres. And essentially what Cooper Robertson did is they proposed a system. Here's Duke Street, a somewhat gridded street network. There's a park over here. This is Eisenhower Avenue, with designating open spaces, designating street landscaping, etc. All the parking, there can be no visible parking. As I go through this, I'm going to give you some of the rules that were laid out. They're not all on these slides. No visible parking is allowed. The parking had to be in structured, in garages, either in the middle of blocks or under buildings. You could have no, there are no parking lots in Carlisle. A model was built to actually show no buildings have been designed, but a model was built that actually shows what the Carlisle plan calls for, and it calls for, it not only says we want it to be this height, it says you can't make it lower. You'd have, in other words, it sets constraints on both how big a building could be, but also no smaller than constraints. Now that's what is that about? That's really an important point. It's again asserting very proactively what the image, you know, what the city of Alexandria wants Carlisle to be like. So the buildings that are built in Carlisle have to fit the template, if you will, created back in 1990. I'm going to share with you also the fact I've been on this thing 15 years. I have learned about a lot of mistakes that were made. So you'll hear me critique this. One of the things they did is they made in the master plan a block by block template for every single building in every block. So here is an example. This is retail around an open space. You see all these dimensions. I mean, I'm not going to bore you with all of that stuff, but there was for every single block in this plan, for every one of these blocks, the form, the heights, all of that, the setbacks, the expression lines, where they wanted cornice lines expressed, not stipulating a style, that was all spelled out. This was a section, this is from the code book, and it shows, again, where they want the setbacks, building bulk, heights, etc. There was additional, and this is called the bulk summary. You'll see this building. Let me just show you the building. In addition to what you saw in plan and section, there are code requirements in the Carlisle plan that say things like there will be no all glass buildings. 50% of the facades in the Carlisle have to be opaque, have to be wall. Whether it's brick, precast concrete, you could have limestone. There was no brick was not mandated, but you could not have a wall or a facade where 80% of it was glass. So that was one of the stipulations. That's arbitrary, but they wanted what they call predominantly punched window language. Punched window meaning that they outlawed the creation of ribbon windowed or all glass facades. That was one of the architectural stipulations. I'm not saying that's what it should have been, but that was what you're going to see in these images is the result of that part of the coding. It also called for, in many locations, retail at the ground level. The sidewalk level was to be retail. One of the mistakes in the Cooper Robertson plan was they did not deploy the retail in a way that would concentrate it and energize it sooner rather than later. A lot of Carlisle has been built now, and the retail is just starting to catch up. And even after it catches up, it's never going to be Bethesda Row. So if we were to start over today, if I could walk into Cooper Robertson's office in 1989, I would tell them that was one of the things they should change is the deployment and the plan of the retail. Here's another, and by the way, the other thing that happens here is that even though there's a model that specifically shows what the buildings might look like, of course, none of them really ended up looking exactly like this. You'll see, for example, right here, this is, again, Duke Street, and there's a building right here that was done by Smith Group. And by the way, developers tended to hire better than average architects. This is another thing about this coding process that you need to consider seriously. Is having design review, which I'm going to talk a little about in a minute. But here is the building. This is the result. This is the building that resulted from the design review process with Smith Group at the entrance to Carlisle. And you can see it doesn't look necessarily like an Alexandria building, but it, on the other hand, is a much higher level of design quality than we would have gotten without the code. This is a residential high-rise over on the park. This is a a four-story residential building near behind that high-rise. And you can see some of the detailing. Now, we, the design review board, every one of these projects has to be submitted to the board for review and approval. It's been a very fruitful process. One thing that happened to Carlisle, this gets back to Nancy Farine's question, about 7 years ago, the Patent and Trade Office, the federal government, GSA, came and said, we'd like to locate in Carlisle. In order to do that, we had to change the plan, because they wanted a series of buildings that didn't fit that pattern we saw earlier, so adjustments were made to accommodate that. And you see the results. Skidmore, Owings & Merrill was the architect, and this is the result. Again, notice how differently the expression is here. That I'm sorry, I keep pushing the wrong button. Notice we had a huge number of meetings, by the way, to refine this. That is, meetings between Skidmore and the development entity and the design review board to get this to the level of quality that you see here. This was one of the flanking buildings, and the parking garage is actually, the government wouldn't accept a below grade parking garage, so there are parking garages flanking this development, completely hidden by a layer of offices that enclose, that separate the parking garage from the streetscape. Here, this is a recently completed piece of Carlisle. You can see the retail isn't quite in yet. The awnings aren't up, the signs aren't in. So I'm going to conclude by telling you that part of achieving design excellence, in my opinion, involves having a process of design review. Not just saying, okay, we're done, we've got the envelopes described. You've got to also have a discussion, a conversation about architecture. And this summarizes, I think, what we're talking about. A well-structured, well-administered design review process motivates applicants to raise the aesthetic bar and try harder, motivates developers to seek better design talent, ensures exploration of the full range of design issues, ensures compliance with form-based codes and design guidelines, and helps applicants, this is very important, helps applicants obtain community support for projects whose design might be unusual or aesthetically controversial. An effective, expeditious design review process, this is equally important, is collaborative, not adversarial. If you were to go talk to people at Skidmore or at Smith Group, what I think they would tell you is that their meetings with the design review board, which are roll up your sleeves, they're like mini charrettes, they were very fruitful, constructive meetings, and they, in all cases, improved the designs. And with the less talented architects, I've always told people that we could get the C-minus projects up to a B. That was a benefit. And if we could get the B projects up to an A-minus, that was a benefit. The process worked also because the very active participation by professional planning staff from Alexandria, although I will tell you they were always overworked and underpaid, there was a tremendous amount of on their plate. It operates in parallel with the permit review process, so it didn't slow down the entitlement process. If it's done right, you make sure it goes along in parallel. And finally, very important, establish a review committee needs to be wisely chosen. It needs to have members who can make informed judgments, are thoughtful in making and informing opinions. This is very important because judging architecture involves value judgments. It's not a matter of just checking off whether a building is within a height limit or if it meets electrical and structural codes. So I'm advocating that Montgomery County have some kind of design review process. There are a lot of other questions. You know, does it apply to everything? Does it apply only to certain neighborhoods or planning sectors? That's something that the county would have to face up to. But if there is a code, For example, this I drew this. This is Seaside, Florida. I was in the very early days of creating codes. A guest of Robert Davis, and he has this cartoon up on his wall. Jeffrey, I don't know if you've seen it in Seaside, but if you've got a code and the code is well written and people know what the rules of the game are, then you can. A design review process is very effective at achieving the goals that you want to achieve, and that gets back to why you do need to code some of these aspirations, and why you need to do it in a fine-grained way. This is obviously an exaggeration, but that's what makes cartoons worth doing. It does mean looking at things in a way that we have not historically looked at them in Montgomery County. Thank you. I'm done.
You want to take a couple of questions, Roger? We'll just take a couple and then we'll go on, because there's going to be room for more questions as we get to the end. Way in the back, somebody is waving frantically at you.
The glare there is such that I can't see.
Wayne?
Oh, no, I see.
Actually, Montgomery County has had a design review board since 1980. It's called the Historic Preservation Commission.
That's not, well, that is not the same thing. That's not a design review board. I don't think we want to get into historic preservation review. I think that's a very important part of what this process, though, needs to encompass, because part of making plans and codes that work for an environment like Montgomery County includes dealing with existing properties, buildings and neighborhoods that are to be preserved, and not just new stuff. One of the things that I maybe should have emphasized is that Carlisle was all new. That was a brownfield, basically.
We have another question. Yeah. David?
When you first started talking about, the design review board, you mentioned that the role of the board was to make suggestions, was to make evaluations and make suggestions, I think was the specific term that you used. And I'm curious, particularly in light of the fact that this is proceeding while the permit process is also proceeding. And maybe it didn't come up in your case because it sounds like it was a very amicable situation, but what happens if push comes to shove? Design review board wants A and the architects and developer want B. How does that resolve itself?
That arose frequently, but again, we usually uncovered disagreements, if you will, about architectural language or architectural design fairly early on. The design review board, though, was authorized. We had to look at all phases of design. So there was a schematic meeting, there was a design development meeting. They would eventually come in and show us the materials and so forth. What we often did is we got to a point where we would defer to the staff. We were close enough that we would say, okay, now it's time to just present your final decision to the staff, not necessarily requiring a board meeting. We were usually on time, so to speak, in negotiating with the developer and the architect. There were times when we demanded modifications, and there were times when we said no, we can live with this. And yes. Oh, yeah. They cannot get a permit. They could not get a permit until we had voted, taken a vote, and approved the design.
One more question. Adam?
What is the role, if any, of public input in the design review standards? The previous speakers had talked about once the plan was done and the code was done, it became sort of a technical it went to the technical people, and are you considering the design review part of the technicality, which there's no public input, or what role does the public play?
The DRB meetings are public. Keep in mind that the original plan and design guidelines, all that was the result of a very, very public process. After that, most of the developers and their architects came in and played by the rules. My experience is they like to have the rules. If they know what the rules are in advance, they're much happier than when it's fuzzy. So we often were talking about very subtle things, some of which the public wasn't interested at all. I mean, the much of the discussion at the design review board's meetings were to perhaps a layperson somewhat esoteric. We were talking about, you know, whether the two bricks that were going to be juxtaposed, is the chromatic contrast adequate? You know, is it? I mean, we would get into very detailed discussions with them. What's the tint on the glass? So a lot of that, the public was happy to defer to the board, but the overall issues of urban design and architecture were pretty much established, but all the meetings are public.
Thank you again, Roger, very much. We've talked about a lot of the issues here generally now, and we're going to move to a discussion of form-based codes in action, so we'll turn back to Farrell.
All right, we'll see. I'm going to talk about Columbia Pike. At the end of my talk, I'm going to focus on Columbia Pike, and then Richard Tucker, who's the Arlington County planner for Columbia Pike, or has been until very recently, will talk to you and tell you all the things I told you wrong. I'm going to talk from the front end, how it was done, what we got done, and brag about the accomplishments. And then Richard will tell you about a lot of the realities. Overall, it's a great thing that we're very proud to have been involved in. But if anyone tells you they're going to get it, they're going to give you a perfect document the first time, you should raise both your eyebrows. Can we lower the lights? Form-based codes in action. I'm going to roll through a little bit this first recognized national trend. It's happening. A couple of different projects we've been involved in across the country. A few years back, a development plan with Public Charette for the Pleasant Hill BART station. This is west of Berkeley. A spot of land, 18 acres of asphalt. Now, see if we can hold on that slide. When they first put the metro out there, the BART, there was nothing out there. It was a BART station in a field. I imagine they paved the parking they needed because nobody lived there. Everybody drove to it. But after about 18 years, or probably more like 10 years, a lot of businesses built up right around that place. And in the ensuing time, there's a big demand. It became very valuable property. There were about 15 years of blood, developer's blood, on that 18 acres of asphalt. Citizens in Berkeley, as far as being tough activists and demanding for development, are 10 on a scale of 1 to 10. There's that 18, the structures that were built around it because the metro was there. Could it be a worse condition? I mean, how could you be any worse than 18 acres of asphalt? Imagining walking past that. It was not a walkable place. But in large part because a politician said, let's do this public charrette and get together and have the citizens decide with the developer and with BART what we can do with that we're going to agree on. This is one of the after pictures. The plan was to turn this 18 acres of asphalt into a town, really a town center, retail, residential, focused on the BART station. Clearly a much better place. They are building the thing now. Getting into issues of color. Very different type of a code, Woodford County, Kentucky, done for the county. This is the bluegrass portion of Kentucky. another plan, Iowa City, Iowa, land that the city owned and wanted to do something, a model project on it, not just another subdivision. Midway, Kentucky, what otherwise would have been an industrial park, we did under a format of streets and blocks, a kind of new urbanist frame, which ended up using the land about 40% more efficiently than the standard way, therefore getting more tax base on less land. And more recently, Farmers Branch, Texas, there's their beautiful downtown to be. That's the before, and that's one of the best looking places in the town. I hope nobody from Farmers Branch is here. Of this, this was a 100-acre site, about 100 acres, zoned industrial. And with the exception of this view, which is, the best part of that 100 acres and the most utilized, we're talking about asphalt, a used tire shop, and a lot of weeds growing up through the cracks of that asphalt. And visualization of what the after is looking like. This is also located on a metro line. And specifics in the plan, like, and Lee showed an example of one of these, that design of that public realm that these private buildings are going to make is very specific and very well thought out about how you balance the automobile with the pedestrian, the bicyclist, the et cetera. And street trees are always, 99% of the time, very important aspects. Let's just jump and rush headlong into Columbia Pike. The plan was adopted in 2003 after much too short a process. Richard will talk more about that. It's great to have a banner over a major street whenever you do any of these things. I recommend it. And this slide, not so much to read this, but within a year of the code being passed, pretty safely close to $1 billion in projects and real estate was under play, being looked at, planned for, and moved ahead on. There are also some projects on the bottom, and I'll tell you, Columbia Pike, the redevelopment areas where the form-based code is applied are in four centers. Obviously, where there's a major intersecting street, these are already natural centers along Columbia Pike. The two projects on the bottom, and I think there may be others, were just outside of those districts, yet their developer somehow got together with the citizens, and by using the form-based code elements as something to talk about, got approval in record time because the citizens felt better about what the developer was doing, and it put the development in a better form. We're not here to talk about how to do public participation and charrettes, but very crucial to why Columbia Pike worked. Things looking at old plans, understanding existing community concepts, and study the bricks and mortar, but equally important, study the people that are there. A lot of Columbia Pike, the bricks and mortar are really lousy, but what's going on with the people is not. Look at how people use the community, and good old nearby examples, some new. In this region, you've got a wealth of them, some old. Get an idea of the kind of place you want to be. And this is actually an important picture because this shows a teamwork of people, these consultants from outside, but also people who live and work in the place.
Hey, Jeff, I was there too. Why am I not in the picture?
You see there's a little arm sticking in the right. I think we cropped you out. It's a teamwork. The people from outside cannot tell you what to do. They can give you advice, help you get there, but it's your place. That teamwork is very important. Charette, first night is a way of talking to people, combination of lecture and open microphone. People often have steam to blow off. And in that lecture, you give people information. You talk about what makes walkable streets. Here's an old precedent. Could you imagine that's New York Avenue? I have to go back to that slide. New York Avenue before, streetcar. Can you imagine having so many street trees, you refer to them as pharaohs, like pharaohs of corn? Of course, we tore that down. The charrette itself is where we do something completely different. We turn the normal process on its head. Citizens, you come in, and we put a pencil in your hand. This is a table of citizens. There's a facilitator there somewhere, I think, standing back. But the whole idea is to get the citizens to draw on maps of the site they're working on and talk about the things they want that to be, the aspirations, and look at it holistically. Normal process, you just come in, and the developer unveils a project, and classically the citizens are reacting to it. This turns that on its head. And by the way, citizen activists, you'll be sitting at a table. The idea is to mix everybody up. You might be sitting at the table with a business owner or operator, and maybe even a developer. And what typically happens is people find out when they're really working together on the things they agree on, sometimes outnumber the ones they disagree on. We get drawings like this. As works of art, they're not. They're ugly or they're cartoonish. But as things that hold on to information, they're really gorgeous. There's so much more information in this kind of drawing as a record of what the citizens wanted than there is if you've got some smooth talker up in front of a big notepad with 12 magic markers between his fingers, and somebody in the back says, "We'd like an aquarium," and he scribbles it up there. That kind of facilitation, I really think, is what results in everybody being very surprised by what happens later. In a situation like this, if someone's going to say, "Well, we'd like to have a town green," and this drawing is a good illustration, they immediately, you've got to confront just where does that go and whose property is that on? Does that work well with the church, or is that problematic? And Columbia Pike is one of the designs and master plans that said, we want to make a community green, and it had to come out of private property. Very difficult thing to do. We'll talk more about that. This is a citizen. Citizens stand up and describe to each other what they did at the tables. This is another citizen. This was a pretty large public participation charrette, you can see. But people are looking at what happens every time in this. If you've got 10 tables of citizens, about 10 or 12 each, when they put their drawings up on the wall and talk about their important points and what they want, people are always, with about a 0.1% exception, people are very surprised and impressed at how much they agree on the very basic things. Because if there was a Martian table in the audience, they'd probably be way off the track, but we're all human beings. We all have basically similar wants and desires. The charrette itself is where we take those citizen plans and deal with some of the reality of the technics. And this is an important image because the people sitting at this table, you might recognize one of them. But Director of Public Works, a transportation consultant hired by Arlington County, director of the pedestrian and bicycle department. The woman in the middle there with the glasses is from WMATA. So what we do is we take that citizen's vision of what they want the place to be, and then we sit down with what I'll call the technicians, the traffic people, the fire department, and we say, now how can we work with what you guys know, because you're experts, how can we do your stuff a little bit differently so we can achieve that citizen's vision? And this is turning the normal process, I think, on its head. That's a citizen there on the right behind the peanuts, not a... What comes out of this generally week-long process is a master plan, that kind of nice-looking drawing that illustrates how things could develop. So recognize the Pentagon on the right. You see the four centers at major intersection, and they had names, town center, village center, neighborhood center, based on their scale. And here they are closer up. They're all illustrations of one way they could develop under the code that has begun to be written. Now, there's always a question, have you ever seen a process where a developer comes or a county planning process? Here's another example of the kind of things we show people. of what happens. This is a specific spot along Columbia Pike, and this is how it's proposed to be developed under the code and the master plan. Have you ever seen a master plan or drawings from an